Good afternoon. In a short while, I will be joined by Robert Piper, the UN Regional Humanitarian Coordinator for the Sahel. And after the Sahel, we will turn to Jean-Victor Nkolo, the spokesman for the President of the General Assembly. On Ebola, you will have seen that the Secretary General just called for the international community to step up its effort and turn pledges into action. The World Health Organization warns of a continuously deteriorating situation in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. An increasing in new cases in Guinea is being driven by a spike in cases in the capital, Conakry, and the nearby district of Koya. In Liberia, there is almost certainly significant underreporting of cases from the capital, Monrovia, while in Sierra Leone, intense transmission is still occurring in the capital, Freetown, and its surroundings. The latest figures from the World Health Organization report a total of 8,997 cases in seven countries and 4,493 deaths so far. Health workers have also been paying a very high price in the fight against Ebola, with 427 infected and 236 who have died following the disease. Total number of operational laboratories in three countries will increase in the coming weeks as a Russian mobile laboratory becomes operational in Guinea and a Public Health England laboratory begins to provide diagnostic and testing in the western rural area of Sierra Leone. The full situation report is available on the World Health Organization's website. Also today, UN Population Fund warns that Ebola is wiping out gains in safe motherhood made in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. An estimated 800,000 women in these three countries should give birth in the next 12 months, but many pregnant women are afraid to visit or turned away from overstretched health facilities. The Population Fund says that $64.5 million is needed to provide reproductive and maternal health services in the next 3 months. Also tomorrow, Sarah Crowe, the Crisis Communications Chief at UNICEF, will be here in this room at 11 o'clock to brief you on her recent five-week mission to Liberia about the role of social mobilization and UNICEF's work with communities. Turning to Syria, Staffan de Mistura, the UN's Special Representative for Syria, met today with Lebanese Prime Minister Tamam Salam. He told reporters that during his second tour of the region, he will also visit Iran, Turkey, and Russia. I'm always happy to hear myself talk, but this may be pushing the limit. Where were you? Mr. de Mistura told reporters after meeting the Prime Minister that during his second tour of the region, he will also visit Iran, Turkey, and Russia. Among the things he was discussing, he said, was the rise of new factors in the region, including Daesh, also known as ISIL. He said the international community remains concerned about the effects of Syrian conflict on Lebanon's stability, and he added that the international community stands firmly with Lebanon. And his remarks are online. The new UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Raad Al Hussein, said today his office was stretched to its limit at a time when the UN humanitarian rights system is increasingly asked to intervene, investigate, press for accountability, and prevent further violations. At a press conference in Geneva, he said that one of his priorities was to resolve the extraordinary disconnect between what his office was asked to do and what it was given to do with. Mr. Zayed noted that his office receives around 3% of the UN regular budget, which covers a third of its total expenditures, and what most of its funding depends on is voluntary contributions, which are currently insufficient to cover the level of activity. He called on the Office of Human Rights to be put on a more stable footing if it is to do justice to its extensive and visionary mandate. He added that states created the international human rights system and should ensure the necessary funding and resources for it. Today is, in addition to being Spirit Day, as we noted from the Secretary General's purple tie, it is also World Food Day. The Secretary General in his message highlights the importance of family farmers, who are the cornerstone of inclusive and sustainable agricultural food systems. He added that although family farmers are key to unlocking global progress, they're at a disadvantage when it comes to access to technology, services, and markets. He calls for equal access to reproductive resources for the world's 500 million smallholder farmers to help eradicate poverty. And this year also marks the International Year of Family Farming. Commemorating the year and World Food Day, the Food and Agricultural Organization has issued a report noting that since the majority of the world's farms are managed by families, Family farms can be crucial agents of change in achieving sustainable food security and eradicating hunger. Tomorrow, my guests here will be the co-chairs of the Intergovernmental Committee of Experts on Sustainable Development Financing. And those co-chairs are Mansour Muttar, World Bank Executive Director for Nigeria, Angola, and South Africa; Pertti Majanen, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Finland. That's it. Matthew, and then Joe.
Sorry, I wanted to ask for what the Secretary General, if he has any comment on the election of Venezuela, Malaysia, Angola, and New Zealand to seats on the Security Council, the runoff now between Spain and Turkey. And I wanted to ask you, what was the thinking of in the middle of that vote, particularly the runoff as the results were being announced, having that stakeout? Is there some – what's the higher kind of protocol in the UN between GAS?
I think as we've often said, the UN building is sometimes akin to a Ringling Barnum Brothers three-ring circus. A lot of things are happening at a different time. The Secretary General's schedule was such that this was the only time he could do it. I was keen to have him speak to the press upon return. And I'm aware of the challenges, but that's why things are a webcast and stored. And I know it doesn't make it easier for journalists who cover the UN to have these things done simultaneously. But that's it.
I'm asking just because there were actually some diplomats that said that there is a kind of an unstated protocol of the various organs. You know, whatever. What about commenting on the actual results and his new partners on the Security Council?
You know, he obviously welcomes the elections of the four new members. Looks forward to working with them, and we await the sovereign decision of member states as to who the fifth member will be. Joe, you had a question.
Yes. You have. Okay, I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, you know what? I have a statement which I should have read in the beginning. Yeah. Which is a statement on the return to Madagascar of former President Marc Ravalomanana. Now, the Secretary General has taken note of the return of to Madagascar former President Marc Ravalomanana on October 13th. He rejects the remarks Mr. Ravalomanana made during a press conference challenging the legitimacy of the institutions born to the country's recent elections. The Secretary General stresses the imperative of respecting the legitimacy of the democratically elected government and the rule of law. He calls on all political actors and stakeholders to continue working together towards an inclusive national reconciliation process, the full implementation of the SADC roadmap, the deepening of democratic governance and economic recovery for the good of all people in Madagascar. And the statement's available in my office, also in French. Mr. Klein.
Yes. On Ebola, sort of a two-part question. First of all, has there been any reconsideration of the Secretary General's apparent and other UN spokespersons' opposition to the idea of at least a travel ban from the affected countries for commercial air flights, not impeding the use of military aircraft, charter planes, et cetera? And secondly, has there been any establishment of a protocol here at headquarters, as well as other UN sites, regarding the handling of any potential Ebola cases? In other words, you know, what would be the procedures for dealing with such outbreaks?
On your first part, you know, it's not so much the Secretary General's opinion, but it's the one of the World Health Organization and other ones of our partners. We continue to hold the position that isolating those countries further would deepen the crisis they're already in. And as we said, it's not only a health crisis, it's an economic crisis, and that can often lead to become a political crisis. So that position is unchanged. On your second part, on the protocol, you know, our medical service here is well trained, as well versed in dealing with different medical emergencies. Should anybody at headquarters show the symptoms, but obviously we would also very much rely on the health and safety resources of our host community here in New York. Oui, and then the back, and then Evelyn.
Stefan, 2 days ago here in this room, Professor Chomsky said that the solution of two states, it's not realistic. By the way, he criticized the United Nations passivity, and he said that the United Nations should follow the European Union, who created directive to sanction the association and the organization who are linked to the colonization in West Bank. What do you think about his?
Noam Chomsky is a man of global reputation, so I'll say this with all due respect. Obviously, he has his own opinion. I think the Secretary General's position, as he reiterated today, a few minutes ago, is that the two-state solution is the only way to stop this senseless cycle of war that we've been seeing. As for issues of sanctions, as you know, those are really up to the Security Council and for member states to take. Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Stefan. Russian President Putin just yesterday strongly responded to President Obama's remarks at the General Assembly last month, in which Mr. Obama criticized Russia as one of the threats to global security, and Mr. Putin warned that the U.S. Should not blackmail Russia over Ukraine. What is UN's position?
I don't think we're not going to get in the middle of the back and forth between world leaders. It is obviously very important and critical to global situation that we find that Russia and the United States work together to deal with a lot of the crises we're seeing in the world around the world today. Evelyn. Your microphone, please.
On Ebola, the plan of 70% in treatment or cured by December 1 is probably not going to work. Is there a plan B?
Look, our focus right now, the Secretary General's focus, the UN system's focus, is on getting the resources to the field, getting the support we need to the countries most impacted. And we're working on, there are a lot of predictions out there. We are working towards the best case scenario to avoid the worst case scenario. Ken.
Can I ask one more?
Evelyn, please.
Yeah, are the diplomats and ministers arriving here get their temperature taken by the United States?
I think you'd have to ask the U.S. authorities what measures they're putting in place. Ken.
Stefan, I've noticed the Secretary General and you called the Islamic State as Daesh recently. Has the U.N. decided to call the group by that name? And if so, why
I
not
think,
Islamic
you know,
State?
There are a lot of different names and acronyms floating around. I think what is clear is that this organization, that group, is neither Islamic nor a state. So we will use different, obviously Security Council has some language we use, but I think what is important is that we keep denouncing the actions, the atrocities they're committing on the ground. Yes.
Thank you. Just recently, while you were with the Secretary General, a non-governmental organization fighting for justice for the people affected by the post-election violence that happened in Kenya held a briefing here where they subtly condemned the warm reception that the Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta got here at the UN while attending the General Assembly, while somebody like the Sudanese president, who is also facing similar charges by the International Criminal Court, has totally been shot out by the United Nations and international community. So is this a case of different strokes for different folks?
You know, I think you'd have to ask those people who've welcomed them. I mean, I'm not going to interpret the different welcomes different heads of states receive here at the UN.
Thank you, Stefan.
The tension remains high in Hong Kong. The Secretary General has...
I think Secretary General's position is unchanged. We're obviously watching it very closely. We hope that there can be talks in order to resolve this this situation peacefully. Evelyn, and then Matthew.
Yes. Sorry, I've just lost my place here. Oh, yes. I still didn't hear any answer from the SG or in the briefing of the question that both James and I have been asking of, is there an answer to Prime Minister Netanyahu's accusation that the rockets in the UN schools were handed back to Hamas?
I think, you know, I would refer you back to what the Secretary General said himself in Gaza, which he said when those rockets were found, we reported it and we informed the world. Yes. Well, we reported publicly. Yes.
Sure. I want to ask about Ebola and also Liberia, and then a follow-up on your Madagascar statement. Mm-hmm. On Ebola, I wanted to know, I'm sure while you may have heard this, while right before you came back, the staff union or whatever is the staff union here said that they are concerned about the right to medical evacuation. And I've received communications from staff in Liberia where they say this right is not acknowledged by UNMIL. So I asked the UNMIL spokesman, and he said, decisions to medevac are made on a case-by-case basis and depend on factors such as the stage of the disease and the ability of the receiving facilities to take patients. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to know is, overall, are international and national staff treated the same by the UN in terms of evacuation? And two, what is this ability of receiving facilities to take patients, this facilities in other countries? What are the rights of a UN
think,
national
you know,
Liberian staff
the
if they contract Ebola?
The concern is that, you know, it's and I think something that's raised not just for UN staff but health workers in general is that are coming in from NGOs is the ability they would have to be medevac. There are obviously not enough medevac planes available. There's a great shortage of them. That's what we're asking. We're asking for more. And obviously, the situation of our own staff is of concern. I'll check with what UNMIL has said, and if I have more, I'll give that
but I
to
guess
you.
Just as a matter of principle, are the rights of international staff members hired to work in UNMIL from other countries?
I don't think it's a matter of higher or lower. I think it's a matter of different contractual obligations.
And also in Liberia, I'm asking this because I tried to get this resolved. The whistleblowers in UNMIL have said to me that the SRSG rents housing at a cost of $8,300 a month, and they find this relatively outrageous. They also say it's rented from her country, Sweden. So I tried to ask them to get them to knock this down if it's not true. They've said that on the SRG accommodation, the UN does not disclose its staff members' personal information. And I guess my question is, I don't want any personal information. I don't want the address. But I think if UN money is going to be paid in the amounts that are alleged, that should be made public.
Right.
So can you answer
if
that?
If I have something on that, I will share with you. So, and then we'll turn to Mr. Piper.
42 days ago, two of the Tunisian journalists, Sofiane Chorabi and Nadir Khtari, were declared missing in Libya. By the way, a week ago, another Libyan journalist, which his name is Mu'ath Libi, was kidnapped. What is the position of the United Nations, especially that you visited Libya and you have many contacts with the government and the responsible government?
I mean, I think what we're seeing, whether in Libya, in Syria, in Iraq, is we're seeing growing threats to journalists, not because they just work, they're working in difficult environments, but because they're being targeted. Specifically for doing the job that they're doing. And I think the Secretary General has spoken out for the need to protect journalists and for the right of journalists to do their work free from threats. Thank you, and we'll get Mr. Piper in, and he will talk to you about the sale. Great. Good afternoon. As promised, we're joined here by Robert Piper, who is the UN's Regional Humanitarian Coordinator for the Sahel, and he is here to brief you on the situation in the Sahel. Robert, welcome. Nice to have you back here.
Thank you, Stefan. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for your presence and your interest. So, as mentioned, I look after the Sahel region. It's 9 countries spanning from the coast, so Senegal and Mauritania and the Gambia, across to Chad, Nigeria, and Cameroon. They're all part of the Sahel belt. I'm based in the region, based in Senegal, and spend naturally quite a bit of time visiting. We continue to be very, very concerned about the region in terms of the humanitarian challenges that are still a reality there. Despite multiple crises around the world, of which you are covering many, certainly on the UN side, with the humanitarian teams, we are not losing sight of the Sahel. And part of my mission to New York is about making sure that member states and others also continue to keep Sahel in their thoughts. We launched a $2 billion humanitarian operation for the Sahel earlier this year. It is funded today at only a little over $1 billion, so barely half funded, which is obviously far too little to get the job done. Food insecurity continues to be a major issue for the Sahel. People's stocks were very low as rains came this year. The rains came very late in many parts of the region. 25 million people today, 25 million people are estimated to be food insecure across the region. Of real concern is during the course of this year, from January to the middle of the year, we saw a real deterioration in the number of food insecure people that slid across this crisis line. We have a way of differentiating different levels of food insecurity, the worst, of course, being famine. But there are lots of grades before that where people take more and more negative coping strategies to deal with the lack of access to food. We watched about 2 million people in the beginning of this year to now over 6 million people have crossed this emergency threshold between January and July. Enormous concern to us as humanitarians. Secondly, acute malnutrition continues to haunt the region. Today, 6.4 million children are severe or moderately acutely malnourished across the region. Some 1.2 million children are estimated to die each year in the Sahel under the age of 5 due to various unnatural causes. About half of those deaths, almost 600,000 children under 5, are dying due to either malnutrition or related factors. Again, a big worry is that we've seen these numbers increase over the course of this, just the 10 months that have passed. About 1 million extra moderately acutely malnourished children have joined these ranks, mainly from Nigeria and absolutely to do with the conflict and displacement in that country. Third, we are monitoring epidemic risks. It's a great reality for the Sahel. It's yellow fever. It's cholera. This year, we have had cholera outbreaks in Nigeria, in Cameroon, 26,000 cases, for example, in Nigeria, over 400 deaths. And needless to say, we're watching with great concern and preparing with a lot of energy for the Ebola crisis that is in the neighbourhood. This is what we call the chronic emergency caseload, the food insecure, the acutely malnourished, people at risk of epidemics. It's an enormous group of people in the region. Any given year, 20 to 30 million people at risk. And these numbers keep going up. With or without a major weather event, they are inexorably increasing because they're driven by real deep structural problems, issues to do with demographic growth, issues to do with climate change, issues to do with access to basic services and so forth. So we have this very large, we estimate about 3/4 of our work in the Sahel this year, so 1.5 billion of that 2 billion, is really about responding to this chronic emergency. The acute crises, on the other hand, have been rapidly increasing during the course of this year, and perhaps the area of deepest concern today is we see millions more people uprooted from their homes and their livelihoods across the region. Northern Mali, I'm sure you've been following quite closely. You've seen the loss of 31 peacekeepers already in the mission. We've lost NGO workers that were killed, two from the Norwegian Refugee Council, ICRC people kidnapped. The returns process back to Mali has virtually reversed itself because the situation has deteriorated so seriously during the course of 2014. Central African Republic has deteriorated since December dramatically. Again, a file I'm sure you're following closely. Over 200,000 people from CAR have fled to the Sahel region into either Cameroon or Chad. The Libya crisis continues to boil over just to the north of the region. And perhaps of greatest concern now is the situation in northeast Nigeria, which has really deteriorated rapidly during the course of this year, is generating a tremendous amount of displacement, 1.5 million IDPs now in northeast Nigeria, and large numbers have also started to cross the border into Niger, into Cameroon. I visit many of these regions, and I visit many of the communities that are hosting these refugees that are coming to seek sanctuary. These are some of the poorest people in the world and certainly extraordinarily vulnerable. Southern Niger, for example, the Difa region, has received about 70,000 people from Nigeria over the course of the last 12 months. Already, this region, 63% of the region is food insecure. And they're now managing an influx of people, which is putting enormous strain on everybody's coping capacities. So between refugees, internally displaced people, and returnees, in the course of this year alone, we've seen the numbers jump from about 1.6 million across these nine countries of the Sahel to 3.3 million. The big numbers coming from, above all, Nigeria, but also also from Central African Republic. This is about 25%, if you will, of the Sahel operation. People have been caught up in insecurity and in conflict. And I'm afraid we anticipate this part of the Sahel operation is likely to increase dramatically during the course of 2015 and is of real concern. Humanitarian aid can buy time for the permanent solutions to be found. We can and we do save lives while decisions are made, while resources are found, while deals are brokered. But the trend, I have to say, in the Sahel is very discouraging. 10 years ago, we were managing a $200 million a year humanitarian response across the Sahel. Today, we seek $2 billion. It's an enormous, unsustainable increase in needs. It tells a terrible story of human suffering, needless to say, and it also is a quite unsustainable financially. The big drivers of the chronic emergency are really to do with structural issues, climate change, demographic, access to services, managing water. And for humanitarians, of course, we don't have the solutions for these long-term structural issues. Nothing can substitute for governments taking responsibility, putting in the right place the policies, and their development partners investing on the right issues. We're starting to see progress. I was in Washington last week listening and seeing the World Bank's program, some very exciting new investments with governments across the region. A drought, a major drought, will set us back dramatically. We don't need a drought to see these increases, but a major drought would, of course, set us back very dramatically. An Ebola crisis really exploding across the Sahel would, needless to say, set us back dramatically. But I think today the greatest threat to what little progress we've made comes in the realm of conflict, of the issue of security and increasing insecurity across the region. So let me finish with three simple messages. One, we need more resources for the Sahel response. We are $1 billion short of what we need to get the job done. Two, we need much faster progress to deal with these structural challenges of the region. That requires governments, donors working together, requires a much more joined up response and a much greater sense of urgency than we've seen so far if we're going to reverse this trend of humanitarian action from $200 to $2 billion, $200 million to $2 billion a year. We need to see more progress on safety nets, more progress on climate change adaptation, more progress on reversing some of the demographic trends. And the third, is that we need some successes on the peace process. We need northern Mali. We need Darfur, which also exports refugees into Chad, into the Sahel belt. We desperately need some progress in Libya, in northern Mali, in Darfur. These peace processes must be successful, must be sustained. And we need to get much smarter with our conflict prevention measures, because we're watching with great anxiety some of the situations around the region that continue to deteriorate without any evidence that we're able to slow this deterioration. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Evelyn? Thank you very much, Mr. Piper. I welcome you on behalf of the United Nations Correspondents Association. My name's Evelyn Leopold, and I have a couple questions for you. Lots of area in the Sahel is arid desert, always has been. How do you encourage planting and agriculture, which is needed for food, given that type of topography? And secondly, Nigeria is not poor. Why is the government not helping?
Thank you very much. I think it's a tough neighbourhood to be a farmer or a pastoralist, and you know, one of the great coping strategies in the Sahel is to move. You move with your animals, and people have this enormous transhumance, this movement of populations, which is, of course, increasingly difficult. And the Central African Republic crisis has had a major impact on the movement of people and their animals as coping strategies to move where the rain is, where the pastures are, and so forth. But you would be surprised, as I was, to find that that even this region, which has so little water, and it's is only managing a fraction of its potential. So the potential irrigation for countries like Burkina Faso, for example, or Mali, is much, much greater than what today they are actually able to do. So there's an enormous amount of water that isn't being captured, and a tremendous amount of agricultural potential which isn't yet really being realised. And so a lot to do in agriculture, but indeed, as with a growing population that will double every 22 to 24 years, we also need to see people diversify. We inevitably see people move to towns, inevitably seeing people start up small businesses and so forth. And the big shift in the last 10 to 20 years in the Sahel is there's a lot more seasonal labourers, people that don't own much land or many animals, that are actually dependent on finding jobs and spending two-thirds at least of their income on food. So we've also had to watch food prices, because this is now having an enormous impact, not just the weather, but food prices on people's food security. But the potential is there. It's much greater than I realised arriving in the Sahel, despite the topography, as you say, and the climate. Nigeria is doing a lot. Let's start right with that statement, because I think it's important. Financially, we have a $90 million appeal for Nigeria. That's part of this $2 billion package. It's a fraction of what is needed financially, precisely because the government of Nigeria, and a lot of wealthy individuals, by the way, are also really, I would say, carrying by far the largest part of the financial burden in terms of dealing with the humanitarian impact of insecurity in the northeast. So it's reasonable to expect Nigeria to carry a big part of the burden. I think it's fair to say they are doing that, and our contribution is relatively modest. I can't give you an exact figure. I don't think it's transparent enough, to be frank, on the Nigerian side. We'd like to have more information about what resources they have and where they're going. But it's pretty clear that they're carrying the lion's share of the task.
Joseph Klein, Canada Free Press. As you know, there have been urgent appeals now for Ebola, and we just heard another call from the Secretary General to ramp up funding to deal with that crisis. We had the donors meeting on Gaza, pledging of $5 billion. Do you find that these more urgent crises are sapping resources that might otherwise be available for more of these structural, longer-term problems that you're dealing with in the Sahel? And if so, how do you think you need to kind of sharpen the message that this is also a very urgent crisis, although not necessarily on the front pages every day.
Thank you. Yeah, probably I need your advice on that last part, but sharpening the message. But indeed, it's hard to say where the funds could have, you know, where the funds that might have come to the Sahel have now ended up. I mean, it's hard to answer that, and it's also absolutely not desirable to enter into some kind of competition, you know, and I'm very skittish about these comparators. You know, are Sahelians more worthy than Syrians for the, you know, the generosity of the US taxpayer? It's not something I'm always very careful to avoid that. There's a lot of suffering out there. We need a lot more resources to respond. It's also correct, however, as you said, that the urgent often crowds out the important. And we see that even in the Sahel, when funding is coming for nutrition treatment for food, but very rarely for, say, health responses or clean water and sanitation. And these are terribly important, or even emergency agriculture, because they will reduce the caseload next year, but we have a lot more trouble getting money for this more preventative interventions than for the immediate response, for the simple reason that there isn't enough money, and the response, the saving the child today, is much more compelling than potentially saving five next year. It's a choice that you and I would also make. It's an easy one, but it's a tragedy, really, and it's a function of lack of resources overall. I'm doing my best to keep the message sharpened and to keep the Sahel on the radar screen. I think donors desperately want to see some new ideas. They've watched this $200 million drift into $2 billion a year, and they can see the trend, and they're very worried about it going in and not getting reversed. And I think we have started to reassure them, and I think firstly governments of the region have started to reassure them that they get it. I haven't had time, but but across the region, I haven't had time today, but from Senegal to Niger, very famously, to Mauritania and Burkina Faso, there's some pretty exciting government-led new investments into food security, into nutrition, into safety nets. That's giving donors a lot more encouragement that the future isn't necessarily as bleak as it looks today. That's important. The other part of the answer is, I think, that they are looking to emergency people to work smarter. And so we have adjusted a lot of our approaches in the Sahel compared to the more sudden onset emergencies. We're working more strategically, we're building capacity where normally we can't, etc. So we've tried to really revise the way we work. And the third piece of this puzzle is really for us to work much more closely with the development actors. This is the frustration for our funders, and we share that frustration. We're only buying time with our humanitarian toolbox. It's absolutely crucial that the structural issues are addressed. And that needs to be done by governments and their development partners. So there's enormous expectations on us that we're working much more in a much more integrated fashion with other parts of the system.
Great. Thank you. Matthew? Matthew Lee, InterCity Press, on behalf of the Free UN Coalition for Access. Thanks for the briefing. Since Spain has just won a Security Council seat, I'm going to start with an EU question. And the EU Commissioner of Budget had said, as to the Sahel, that, quote, some projects in the Sahel region of Africa have been postponed due to EU funding declines. So I wanted to know, I would assume that as the coordinator, can you say, what is it true overall that it's declined, and what projects in particular have been canceled? And I also wanted to know how your work has either continues or doesn't to work with the Sahel strategy that was propounded by Romano Prodi and is now, headed and is not based in the Sahel. There was some controversy. One of the member states, Chad, said that it should actually be based in one of the five countries that it covers, but it wasn't. What do you say to that, and how do you work with it? Is it a useful tool to look at the strategy, including counterterrorism and humanitarian issues? Thanks.
Thank you. I think this is Ms. Georgieva on the EU side, who's about to become the Vice President for Budget. Yeah, she's previously the head of the humanitarian part of the EU. What she said quite correctly is that some projects have been postponed because they had a funding, a liquidity crunch. So they had to move their approvals to later in the financial year But the EU funding for the Sahel remains the same as last year. So it wasn't a decline, but it indeed was. They moved some of their funding back, and a lot of the funding from the US could have made the difference up in terms of coming online earlier. The US and the EU are well ahead of all other actors in the region. Between them, 40, 50% of the total is from these two, almost 50% of these two actors. The Sahel strategy is perhaps a more complicated question. It's now, if you will, based in the region. Mr. Prodi's office has closed. The team have moved to Dakar, Senegal. So they are in the Sahel. There's five Sahel countries that would like it to get even closer to the Sahel, because right now this week the special envoy is trying to stand up some staff based out of Bamako that will be joining an AU team that will form the secretariat of a coordination platform for the Sahel that is chaired currently by the Malian government. I work quite closely with the strategy. It has three pillars, one on governance, one on security, and one on resilience, so trying to break this cycle of crisis that is generating these millions of very vulnerable people. And I'm the coordinator for that third pillar. So the short answer, Matthew, is yeah, I am working very closely with that process. I think its potential is far from being realised yet. It's been a pretty slow birthing process. And it's really starting now to come together, I think only now. We're all sort of disappointed at the speed, but fairly optimistic that we're going to start seeing much better results in the coming months.
Thank you. Go Kamoshita from NHK, the Japanese public TV. Country like Mali, which is now facing the threat of these Muslim extremist group in the north, is maybe now facing the threat of Ebola from the south. So I think the U.S. Mr. Evela Duz mentioned to that recently at the Security Council. So do you think that this part of the world could be the one which may face the two major global threats? And what is your concern, and what, it's maybe too hypothetical to ask you, but what could be the threat of this combination of the two threats?
Yeah, I think that's probably the perfect storm, what you're defining. I mean, and that's a sort of fairly terrifying scenario. I think, obviously, Mali is going through a very difficult transition process to peace and is very, very vulnerable, and we've seen the security really deteriorate dramatically this year. They are indeed one of the frontline states. A lot of energy is going into preparedness for Mali, as it is in other parts, Côte d'Ivoire, other parts of the region. I'm following the preparedness part fairly closely, of course, and I have to say, having witnessed the drama and tragedy that's unfolding in Sierra Leone, Liberia and Guinea, and having seen the success of Senegal and Nigeria in responding very quickly to the very early cases, I think your scenario is too pessimistic in the sense that levels of awareness are so high now that the response is going to be, even if we get a case in Mali, and it is possible, of course it's possible, very possible, the response will be much faster and much more effective than it might otherwise have been. I think I speak with prime ministers and others, and I bring up this Ebola preparedness issue when I've had the opportunity. They're all on the case, in many cases, personally chairing committees to prepare, I mean, to give you an idea of the level of awareness. So I'd like to respond by saying I think your hypothetical is too pessimistic. I don't think it's likely, because I think Mali is getting ready, and the level of response capacity and awareness is such that it will and it must respond if there is a case. So I'd rather stop there than imagine what it could be like, but indeed, it's a gloomy it's a gloomy thought that we probably need to think about, just as we say, let's plan for the worst, even if we hope for the best. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Stefan. Thank you, Mr. Piper. Bon après-midi, good afternoon to all. My name is Jean-Victor Nkolo. I'm the spokesperson for the President of the General Assembly. As you may well suspect, the actuality, what has been happening today, is focusing on the elections of five non-permanent members of the Security Council. Over the past 10 minutes, the President of the General Assembly, His Excellency Sam Kutesa, has congratulated the five countries elected. And I would like to list them. For the African and Asia-Pacific states, Angola and Malaysia. For Latin America and the Caribbean, the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. For Western Europe and other states, New Zealand and Spain. So you have these five countries. When it comes to the election of Spain, this was obtained after the third ballot, which was restricted to Spain and Turkey. And Spain obtained on the third ballot 132 votes, Turkey 60 with one abstention. You will have later on our website the details of all these results. We will put them online sometime this afternoon. I just want to recall that this were a secret ballot, and it's important to stress it. Any questions? Yes.
How many votes
did Turkey get? Turkey got 60 on the third ballot. We can give you later on. You'll have that on our website, the votes each country obtained on each ballot. Yes, Mathieu.
Sure. I don't know if you'll answer this, but this is what I asked Stefan. I wanted to know whether – I've heard from some diplomats, although not from your office. Is the GA the sort of highest organ of the UN system, i.e., when it decides to be having a vote to elect Security Council members, is that sort of what would be considered the big thing at the UN that probably other things might defer to?
I wouldn't use the word highest. I would just like to say that this election took place in the General Assembly and the proceedings were chaired by the President of the General Assembly, Mr. Sam Kutesa.
Okay.
Any other question? And I'll wish you a very good afternoon. Bon après-midi à tous. Thank you.